Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. 310 Division Street is back in the news. There was a delegation before Cobourg Town Council recently seeking clarification regarding changes to the emergency care establishment bylaw over language related to licensing. Council was seeking to limit the number of establishments to 2. The Transition House Board has concerns due to the organizational structure between the shelter and Northumberland County, the building owners. Despite the pleas, Council passed the bylaw changes. Then there was the Northumberland County Social Services Committee meeting earlier this month, where public concerns were raised regarding the shelter and its operation. All this comes on the heels of a motion passed by Cobourg Council to hold a public town hall gathering before June 5th to hear more feedback about the operation from businesses and residents nearby. In this interview, you will hear Transition House Executive Director Ike Nwibe respond to all these issues and more. The entire show is dedicated to his answers to key questions. He will talk about the last 6 months, sharing statistics, successes, and challenges. Have a listen and see if you are satisfied with the answers. I'm so glad to welcome back Ike Nwibe, Executive Director of Transition House. Good to see you again on Consider This Northumberland.
Thank you, Robert. Thanks for having me.
It is nearly 6 months since Transition House moved into its new building. How would you characterize these first months?
Thank you, Robert. That's a very good start. It's been wonderful. I would say, you know, there's been a lot of ups and downs. We've had a lot of, good success stories, a lot of challenges, a lot of learning, a lot of unlearning to do, and all that. But it's been worth the while. That's something. Looking back, would we rather do it? Be where we were before? I would say that absolutely not. What we have now is way better than what we used to have. Each time we remind ourselves of where we have come from, and then how the service users perceive or how they are now being served as compared to how it used to be. So it's a wonderful opportunity to operate out of 310 Division.
How would you say your clients look at the services you offer now? Can you give us some examples and some insight into that?
Right. So we came from a place where we didn't have the opportunity for couples to be able to access services together. We didn't have that opportunity to be able to support individuals who own pets. We didn't have that opportunity to support persons who identify as LGBTQ plus. But for now, all that is things of the past. We are now able to support persons who have accessibility needs, couples, persons who own pets, and and so on and so forth. So we're not saying that we are 100% there yet, but we keep on pushing, and then exploring more possibilities and all that. So it's totally different from where we have come from.
How many people have you helped overall from all the programs you offer and all the services you offer? Can you give us some idea of just in total numbers, how many people have been helped by the new Transition House?
Right. So in terms of the unique clients, we've supported at least 160 unique clients. And then this is both the emergency shelter, the hub, and then the transitional housing. We just opened the transitional housing less than 2 weeks now, that is supporting individuals in need of transitional housing services. And so altogether, it's an average or a minimum of 460.
At one point, you were announcing highlights to the public. This included the number of people who obtained housing and alternative housing plus treatment. What are your most recent statistics?
So since opening, at least about 12 people have moved into permanent and appropriate housing. And we've had at least 15 partners who actively support the work we do at the site, who by that I mean they come on site a number of times a week to support our mutual clients. It's cut across mental health support services, substance use, ID and income support, employment support services, programming generally to help folks develop life skills and all that. So all this has been, because I should mention as well, legal assistance in terms of helping folks understand the legal framework, the legal space, and especially those who are involved with the justice system, and as well food security, and so on and so forth. All these are some of the activities that have been happening in the space. We have partners who come on site because we get support, for instance, from the food banks, because you can't rule out food insecurity when you're dealing with homelessness or poverty and all that. So we have partners who have come on board to be able to complement the efforts that we are, the support we're able to get from the food banks, and they get on board, join in serving the food, interact with the clients, and then also develop their own relationship. And these are some of the changes we've seen, and more partners keep coming on board to want to find out how can they be part of what we're doing, how in what ways can they help.
Are you helping more people now than you were helping before?
Definitely. First off, looking at it from the aspect of the number of people in the first place, we've never had this number of unique clients. We've never had that. But because the doors are now open we have more rooms to be able to accommodate people. For instance, we moved from a facility that could only support up to 22 individuals, which according due to the ECE bylaw had to be reduced to 10. And then we moved into a facility that could now support 35 individuals in the shelter, and then up to 20 persons in the warming and cooling hub, and up to 10 persons in the transitional housing. So with that alone means that we now have the capacity to be able to support more persons. We came from a place where we didn't have room for programming. We didn't have room in terms of if a partner were to come on site and then they need some kind of privacy to be able to work with their clients. We didn't have that back then. But now we have that space to be able to do programming. We have space to be able to do confidential, connections with clients. We also have the ability to hold case conferencing. We have the equipment for that on site. We have the ICT equipment also on site for clients who need to use internet services. They need to do apartment search. They need to do job search or even attend online schools or anything of that nature. We have all that in place currently, which were not possible previously.
In the most recent report that was given to Northumberland County, there was a report that said that there were 195 unique visits from November to April. Where do most of these people come from?
So the majority of them, I would say, are from the area. We have, as per our protocol, and then by that I mean Northumberland County.
Okay, before you get too far into it, do you have a specific number? Can we talk in specific numbers rather than in generalities, please?
So I would say that 40 to 45% are from the immediate area. By that I mean Hoboken. And then the others, I would say another 40 to 45% from the immediate other towns within the county. And then the remaining would be from like other communities, you know, of which our protocol is that whenever persons show up, when they have come from other communities that don't, because for anyone to be able to qualify to benefit from our services, they have to be from within the Northumberland County. So if we identify anyone who is coming from outside of the Northumberland County, of course, our approach is to, first of all, cater to the safety of that individual. For instance, somebody comes in at about, say, late in the night, and then they're in need of shelter or anything. We would first take them in, ensure that they're safe, and then by morning would, get them on their way to where they actually should be accessing services based on the location where they have come from. So yes, so that's the thing. Like, we have quite a number of people. They have lived in the area. So many people were born in the area, but for one reason or the other, they have lost their house and they've lost their jobs. And then this is the community they've always known. Some of them have to keep on staying connected to where they have a support system. The support system in this case could be, you know, friends, family, other family members, or even the various community partners that have been supporting them since they've been on their path to begin getting back on their feet. So these are some of the reasons why we have seen individuals choosing to remain within the place where they get the most, help.
In the same report, it outlines that people coming to you or are living rough is mental health or addictions. Do you have any idea how many people seek help for addiction and mental health issues that cross your threshold?
So it's hard to be able to tell how many people require mental health services, because from our experience, we've learned that virtually everybody has some kind of mental health, you know, of which today one might be up there, like you're hyper, you're like good to go, everything is working perfectly. And then from another day, one is down, you know. So for some people, it's kind of fluctuates like that. So as a result, it's pretty hard to be able to determine, say, this is the number of people who require this support, or if to even determine, do we even need the service in place? Because we've heard that, you know, there's been some kind of rhetoric like that in the community where people assume that, where some people think that the number of persons accessing help should be the determining factor if you want to put certain services in place. But from our experience, we've learned that it is best to have those services in place so that whenever, you know, individuals require those services, they're there to be able to support, you know, for them to be able to access. That way, there will be better outcomes and all that. So, for instance, somebody might be functioning at their best today or the whole of this week, everything is moving on well and all that. And then they receive a news that, oh, that housing application you put in for some time ago, it's just been, you have just been denied or something like that. Of course, that would could contribute to a breakdown in their mental health and all that. If we didn't have mental health support services in place to be able to support individuals in that situation, then they would just be there without any kind of help. Or if we begin to now do the connections at that level, a lot could go wrong before we are able to get it right. So I'm not sure if I answered the question.
Well, I guess where I'm going with this is that the Ontario government is pushing to get different types of services, not the same kinds that we see in our community today, that would treat clients in a very different manner than the one that you treat them as. And I guess when you look at the clients that are coming through and the kinds of services you're offering, whereas the alternative being what the Ontario government is pushing for, can you contrast those two systems and which one is best serving the people of Cobourg?
So I, from experience, I do not think that, I think the best way to support individuals is to support them, for them to be able to support themselves. Because our clients, we do not pretend to be the experts in the, you know, in the situation. We believe that they are there's so much to learn from them, and then on how best to be able to address their issues. If somebody is not on board what we are proposing, most likely it's going to lead to failure anyway. So the best way to be able to support individuals while we are encouraging them, we know that, okay, this, if you do this, it's going to be better for you. There will be better outcomes and all that, and then better for the community. We encourage that, we have that in place, while we also have those services available should anyone choose to want to do, to go that path. For instance, we have, on the 1st of March of this year, Transition House decided to discontinue distribution of drug use equipment. We used to do that in the past where folks could come in and then get kits for drug use. Not the drugs itself, but the equipment for that use. We have reasons for doing that, being that, okay, we'd rather save lives than let people engage in unsafe practices and all that. But we reviewed the whole thing and felt we don't allow the use of the drugs on site. So, but we provide them with the equipment to use it. How about we offer this, you know, there are other partners in the community who do this, you know, maybe let's stay focused to our core mandate, which is housing and all that. And then we did that starting March 1st, but we didn't stop it there. What we did then was to now start looking into bringing on board partners that deal with the issues of treatment. For instance, if any individual chooses, okay, I want to access treatment, let ensure that that is in place. And then for those who want to quit, you know, and then they want to do it gradually so that we have methadone services and all that in place as well. It has always been in the community, but the problem is that individuals who require that service, they would have to go to the place to get it. So we're like, okay, that on its own is could be a discouraging factor. Individuals will, I have to go this far, considering the problem of transportation, community, and all that. And then they could get discouraged and not even access that service at all. What we did was, okay, bring that service to the site so that individuals who need it can access it. This is how we perceive it to be, what we perceive to be the, you know, the best approach. Have the services in place, encourage individuals to be able to access them, as opposed to forcing those services on the individuals. From our experience, we've learned that that does not work because it only sets individuals up for failure.
There are many in our community who are pushing to see the decentralization of services similar to yours across the county. What's your reaction to that plan?
Right. So it's I would say it's a good call because if we have services closer to people, it's a good way to go. However, it's important that we look at things in general and not just from the standpoint of most times people only look at the mental health and substance use component of homelessness and how that affects the community and things in the community. And then so, you know what, we'd rather this is removed or maybe spread across different locations. Yes, while you may have addressed that issue of individual spreading the numbers across, how about addressing the reason why individuals are like in a particular location? For instance, the services that those individuals require, most of those services as we have it today, they're concentrated around, not far from where our services, our facility is located. So apart from the fact that, yes, people are coming to transition house or treatment division or anything, one of the reasons why they choose to stay in transition house is also because of proximity to services such as what I've, listed earlier. And in addition to that, you have the, Ontario Works, which most of the clients are on. And then you have ODSP, you have, the outreach, various outreach services and all that. Do we want to also ensure that all these services are made available in those locations? In a way, how we are looking at doing that, for instance, is that we've been able to secure some kind of support where we're looking to procure an accessible vehicle that can help us, that is geared towards us actually making services available to individuals in their various communities so that they're not looking at coming to pretend division or transition house as the only solution to their problem. Our priority has always been in supporting individuals where they are at. And then before, if an individual reaches out to us, for instance, they're asking to get shelter services, we first of all look at why is this the next thing? Why is it the next option? We ask questions like, what's going on? Where were you last night? Where have you been the last 6 to 12 months? Things like that to help us understand the situation. If it is a case of maybe it's food insecurity, or we look at how can we bridge the gap. If it's a case of, or they're behind on their rent, or they need some kind of support with that, we look at addressing that instead of identifying shelter as the only way forward. Where that is now, where all these options don't work, and then it becomes evident that they have to be in shelter, then, we'll proceed with the admission process. So with the procurement of a vehicle, for instance, it makes it possible for the outreach team to be able to easily, meet this person's where they're at, serve them where they're at, and all that. And then that's how Transition House is looking at, this is what we can contribute to further elevate the concerns of the community, over the next few months.
Speaking of concerns, in your report to the county, you track people registering concerns or complaints. Can you tell us how many you receive per day?
It depends. And then this are tracked from different components. For instance, we have what goes directly to the security, and then we track what comes directly to Transition House. But in my own, from my own perspective, I would say there are days that go without one complaint. While there are other days, maybe one, and then some other days it might go probably more than that. But the complaints are usually there is this, somebody has dropped this garbage around here. Can you make an arrangement to come and remove it? Or there are some people who are congregating around here. They shouldn't be here, that kind of thing. And then would make an arrangement for the security team who get there like in a number of minutes to move individuals on. and other things around, maybe like probably noise or things of that nature. So this is it. What I can say anyway is that we have moved from a place where it was pretty high when we started, and then it started to drop because of the measures that were made. For instance, constant reminder to our clients on a weekly basis. We have the residents meeting where we remind clients of the fact that they are members of the community, and then they also play a role in ensuring that there is decency, there is respect for everybody. The same way we want respect from others, we need to also give the same. And all that, we do those constant reminders to our clients. And then if anything is brought to our attention, we try to identify the individuals who are concerned, and then also look at how can we further support them in ensuring that is not something that continues. But another thing that is important to note is that there are so many activities that happen, or so many individuals who engage in certain behaviors, that are always classified as related to 310 or transition house. And those individuals may not necessarily be clients or service users at 310. So, but because as per the ECE bylaw, because these things are happening within the 500 meter radius of the facility, by default, most people would say that, yes, that is something that is related to 310, and then I have to send my complaint to 310 division. So yes, these complaints come, and all that. It's at that level where we're able to now, redirect folks and say, okay, this one here should be going to the police. This one here, okay, we'll send somebody out immediately. Or this one, no, it's not related to ECU bylaw. It's a lot of, disaggregation that happens there.
Well, according to the report that was given at the Social Services Committee, there have been 190 complaints or concerns documented as of April 26th. That seems like a lot. And also there's charts that show, the hours in which calls come in, and they seem to come in almost around the clock. Now that you're being able to redirect it, that's one thing. But what about just the fact that there are so many concerns and so many complaints?
Yeah, no doubt. Like when any, if you bring together that number of people in a, to a place, it's one would expect that it's almost impossible to expect that there's not going to be any kind of complaint or any kind of concern or whatever. But what we also consider as a success is, okay, when these complaints come, how fast are we able to respond to those complaints? And then how fast are we able to address those concerns and all that?
Well, do you track that?
Well, yes. I believe the last time it was in about 3 to 3 minutes thereabout, as per the report from the, like I said before, it's not just transition house. There is the security component to it. There is also the county component, the outreach team, and all this is put together and all that. So an average of three minutes thereabout the last time I checked.
How often are you inspected by officials?
There is no particular. Well, we have seen not like a report to transition house, but it's been said that there has been 116 inspections, but I'm kind of lost. Because when there is an inspection, I am the one who is in charge at that facility. And apparently there are inspections that happen without me knowing about it. So it looks like when the bylaw, for instance, drives past 310 division, maybe they take a picture of something that is happening, that is probably considered an inspection or something like that. But since we opened, there's been one, well-organized inspection because we were notified. And then we prepared ourselves, we confirmed the availability, and then they came, we clarified our protocol and all that. But in addition to this, there was an other inspection that I believe it was sometime in April, when there was an inspection. It was at between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. You know, when the bylaw and the fire department showed up and all that. That's something we didn't know about. Something they showed up, and then according to them, that is part of their protocol and all that. So, but so far, these are about the two inspections that I know of. So, but it's hard to be able to tell how often that we're supposed to be inspected or that we are inspected.
How do you feel about the fact that there are these inspections that are taking place where you're not notified or you're not there?
Yes, I think it's a little bit concerning, in the sense that at the point you now wonder what the intent really is, if it is to get towards improving processes, or like we have heard from different times, that it is all about residents' safety and all that. If it is about residents' safety, for instance, like somebody who somebody has the right to be able to rest at, say, 3 a.m., you know, like while that is my own workspace, it is somebody's living space and all that. So if we're going to have, if there is an incident, I can understand that. Like there is an incident that requires for serious intervention, that totally I get. But if it is a random, I think better planning should be able to go into that, so that we are respectful of persons. We can't show up at somebody's, home, for instance, somebody who is housed in their own private residence, and say that at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. and say we're doing an inspection and all that. But this is how we view this. This is okay, because it is homeless individuals that we're talking about. More like they don't have a voice. It's okay. Certain things can be done to them. Nobody's going to speak for them or something like that. I think certain things should be done properly, and then respecting everybody who is involved, regardless of their housing status.
You feel the town is treating you reasonably?
I wouldn't be able to give a yes or a no answer. But I would just say that I have concerns. As the executive director of Transition House, I have concerns, and I do not think that in accordance with the rhetoric that we have heard, this is get towards resident safety, or anything like that. Sometimes I get to question that, like if certain actions are actually about residents, safety. Because it looks like it can never get its rights the way it is, because certain requests are made. We want you to start doing this going forward as per the ECE regulation. We start doing that. And then a few hours, a few days after that, they push the bar again. So it's at the point, it looks like, what exactly are we get towards? I keep saying to our partners and, the staff members that I've not actually, since this is my 18th, I've been around for 18 months in the role, I do not feel that I've been able to really settle to do the job that I'm employed to do. because each time it looks like we are constantly putting out fires. We are constantly putting out fires, you know, and then responding to issues that, you know, that can actually be addressed without necessarily causing any kind of disruption to our operations. You know, the recent one, for instance, is the fact that we've had to remove the recliner chairs from the warming hub and then replace those with regular plastic chairs. And then, you know, we've had to reduce our occupancy to be able to align with, you know, the ECE regulation and all that. Each time we comply with everything that's been asked of us. Each time, for instance, we were given a fine because when there was an inspection, the one of the three, between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m., 10 out of 13 persons, according to the report, 10 out of 13 persons were seen to be sleeping in the space. And then that is considered a contravention of the bylaw. Now, in my home, for instance, my bedroom is where I sleep when I want to sleep at night. But if I might be watching TV in the living room and in the doze off, it doesn't necessarily make that my sleeping space. But does it happen? Yes, it happens. And then in the case of homeless persons who might be experiencing, who in some cases maybe use substances, or they live rough, they moved around, they do what we cannot expect, that there will be no time when they would, you know, doze off or something like that. And this is at 3 a.m. and all that. But the good thing anyway is that we have, a process is currently ongoing for us to review the fire safety plan, so that certain language there can be changed and in respecting some of this, the actual, situation, the reflecting what would most likely be expected or can be seen in a facility of that nature. It's not a facility, anyhow facility, but a kind that supports persons experiencing homelessness. So it's almost impossible for us to expect that they are not going to doze off in the space, they're not going to sleep off or something like that. So, but I'm glad that there's been some kind of a shift on the part of the fire department. I'm thankful for their understanding and their willingness to work with us to review the fire safety plan, and then so that we can return to normal operations.
What's the status of your fine?
We have paid it. We have paid the fine, and so we also...
How much was it?
$250. Another thing that was included as what they consider a contravention was the fact that when they came on site, staff were not... there was no on-duty supervisor, of which, as per the safety plan, our staff, every staff member on shift is considered on-duty supervisor because they have been trained. They know what to do in case of any eventuality, if they are to do any form of evacuation. The other thing is that somebody did not have the staff member did not have the key to be able to switch the fire alarm to the second stage. That is something that I believe could have been clarified if the inspection was done where they announce it and then we're able to, or even if they reach out to us afterwards to say, why was this like this? We'll be able to make the necessary clarification and say, this is our protocol. Like, we have 24-hour security. Like, security is there 24/7. They are the ones who carry the master, you know, key for the building all the time. So there's no requirement for staff to be able to carry that. The staff have the key for clients' rooms and the common areas. So these clarifications could have been made before the authorities choosing to proceed with, yes, you need to get a fine. But I think we lost an opportunity for process improvement there, for system strengthening, for better collaboration between partners and community. And then rather, it was the case of, more like punitive as compared to system improvement.
There was a delegation from your board appearing at town council meeting to request a change to the bylaw regarding licensing. It comes down to a limit to the number of emergency care establishments in the town. Right now, they're saying there can only be two licenses. Now, there's a difference between the operator and an establishment. That seemed to be the crux of it all. Can you tell us what brought this about and how serious a threat it is to your operation?
I think the drafting of the, it could be two things. The fact that maybe the drafting of that were the amendment of the bylaw was not, probably could have been done better, or probably there was an intention to reduce the whole thing to two licenses, because 310 division as it is requires two licenses to operate, one from the operator and one from the owner of the building. So if the town is saying that we're limiting it to two licenses in the whole of Coburg, that means that there can only be just 310 division. We also know that Cornerstone is there, another organization that supports service users, which also require a license to operate. If they were to secure their license prior to us, that would put us in a difficult position. Then we would not, given the way that amendment was drafted, it would put us in a difficult position so that we would not be able to get a license, because we require two to operate. The town requires two in the whole of the town. And so it was a good thing that our board decided to reach out, because it was we felt that was a potential way of shutting us down if care is not taken. But we are glad that got everybody, thinking like, okay, there is a need for us to actually further clarify this and then make it clear for everyone to be able to understand that, okay, like as 310 division is, yes, we require both the operator and the owner to secure a license, but that facility will be considered one license. So that clarification wasn't made initially, but we are glad that everybody got thinking and then that clarification was made eventually.
But as the bylaw stands now, this is still not completely resolved. That's at least my understanding at the last meeting. Has that changed since that meeting, or is it still something that's up in the air? And I know your license is coming up in November.
Yes, it's coming up in November. And then we've asked that be as per the explanation that was given. They made it up to the director to be able to interpret that. And then we feel that could be something that is that could be problematic. What if one director today understands, okay, this is my understanding of this, and then a different director is there tomorrow who has a totally different, understanding of that? So we were of the opinion that this has to be put in writing so that everybody can easily understand, and then we can hold everyone accountable based on what has been decided. So we have asked that be put in writing. But so far, based on the what was said at the clarification that was given, is that our facility is considered one license, although both Transition House and the county are required to get to apply for a license, but 310 division as a facility is going to be considered one ECE establishment.
Well, that sounds very technical. So just for clarity, are you concerned that you could lose your license come time for renewal?
If I wouldn't say no. Yes, because if that is not fully clarified and well documented in the bylaw to say this is what the protocol, this is what is required. Yes, that could potentially shut us down. The ability not to, I mean, our inability to secure a license could shut us down. And then we would want that clearly stated by the town to say this is the, you know, this is the way they are interpreting it.
So will you be going back to the town at some point to get that clarification?
We have, you know, requested that communication be made. Maybe we are also looking at, yes, connecting with different that's different town staff to further look at how to better understand things from their perspective and all that. These are all what we are hoping to clarify. We don't want to wait until when our license is up for renewal before these issues are brought up. We want to make a proactive, you know, effort to clarify that.
There continues to be an outcry from residents and businesses regarding Transition House. There also has been a motion passed by council recently that calls for a public meeting to be held by the town. First of all, what is the current activity of the liaison committee? Because I thought that was their job, was to monitor this kind of thing.
Right. So the that in line with the point I raised earlier, the fact that we, as a system, we introduce or we make a requirement. When that requirement is met, we move on from it to something else, rather than looking at how can we use that platform to be able to address our concerns and all that. So, for instance, the community liaison committee is there. And then there's also a request for a town hall or anything like that. While I am not against the town hall, and I think people should be able to air their views, they should be able to, you know, if something affects them, they should be able to seek redress and all that. But I can say clearly that the CLC has been doing fantastic work. You know, we're meeting regularly, and then when they have concerns, they bring it up, and then we, as the operator, we're able to make clarifications where there is a where there is need for it. So, in terms of the concerns from the community, just within the last week, I've met with at least two different groups, and you know, to this is in addition to the CLC meeting itself, and then of course other operational meetings that go on here and there, and then these are all related to you know, some concerns and all that, but sometimes it's could be as a result of somebody not understanding this is actually I'm bringing my concern to the wrong table. There are different bodies in the community. If something is an illegal practice, if you notice something, someone engaging in illegal activity, it is law enforcement that should be, you know, brought to. It should be brought to the attention of law enforcement right away so that it's addressed. We are not excusing, I mean, the fact that somebody is experiencing homelessness, but it's not licensed for them to engage in, you know, unlawful practices. You know, they have to be held accountable just like every other member of the community. But because it is this one now might be in our situation, certain activities might be deemed related to the shelter. So it is for the shelter to deal with. And all that further makes it, you know, make the problem even bigger than what it is.
But Ike, you can appreciate it. If I'm a business owner or I'm a resident that lives nearby, these are all jurisdictional battles. I just want to not get fined needles in my garden. I want to not have to walk down and see people out front of my business driving away my clients, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I appreciate the spirit of what you're saying and what you're calling for. But at the same time, from their perspective, it's frustrating to think, you know, well, who do I phone in this particular instance? They just want this stuff to end so that they can do their business and live their lives in their home.
Yes, I mean, and that is actually very valid, and I am also not in any way taking the position of that it's not okay for business owners who feel that certain things are affecting their business for them to speak up. By all means, people should speak up and all that. We're not taking the position of the problems are not there. We know they are there. We are taking that position of, okay, how can we work together to be able to address this situation? This member, these individuals that we support are also members of our community. How can we ensure that while we're supporting them, it is also, we're taking into, we're also prioritizing the success of your own business, your clientele, the safety of everyone in the space and all that. How can we also clarify that certain things are not everything is a safety issue. Sometimes it could be an issue of comfort as opposed to safety. When I see an individual based on how they present and all that, you know, I already have that at the back of my mind that this is a homeless person, and then a homeless person, maybe it's more likely to commit a crime or something like that. Like there are some of these conceptions, you know, in the space. Having those difficult conversations, you know, is part of the solution. And then it helps where we are united, where we're looking at it from. Yes, we might be looking at it from one perspective of how, as the operator, other people are looking at it from the place of a business and all that. Like on our own part, for instance, we are reminding clients and also having this conversation in-house. Like, for instance, the last meeting was around, if you own a business, how would you feel if people congregate around? Like we are having those conversations at our own level. And then in addition to that, briefing the security team from time to time about the need for them to be able to move folks on when these concerns are brought to our attention and all that. Everyone is working, you know, together. The police has also clarified certain things that should be coming to their own attention, like should be brought to their attention when it happens. And to the CLC point, I mean, the point about CLC, the CLC is also working, you know, working to come up with some kind of communication that's going to go to the to immediate neighbors and all that, on that simplifying. If you find this, this is who you call. If you notice this, this is who you like, separating those so that at the end of the day, people are not in doubt. When they observe anything, they are wondering, is this something I call the police about? Is this something I bring to the attention of transition house management, and so on and so forth.
Do you think you can find a way to exist harmoniously within the town? Yes or no?
I think we can. Yes, I think we can.
So how do you achieve that then?
Now the other thing, I like I've heard concerns around. This is something I've heard, where somebody says, "Oh, in my town, in this town, I've never had to lock my door. I've been around here 15, 17 years ago, and then we would leave our doors open and, you know, everything is safe and all that." But I think the times are different. Like this, unfortunately, you know, certain conversations are going to be tough and all that. But the question is that if I choose to leave my door open, somebody breaks in and, you know, certain things happen and all that. Is that something related to my own action, or it is related to the next door neighbor who's came to do what? While that might not quite sound like what many people want to hear, the truth of the matter is that housing situation has worsened from how it was 15, 10, 20 years ago, which has also, you know, affected the situation of, you know, drug use, and also affected people's mental health and so on, and related matters and all that. So we cannot it's almost impossible for us to assume that things, given these problems that keep on growing, the housing crisis, the mental health situation, drug use, the opioid crisis, and so on and so forth, given all these issues that we're dealing with as a system now, it's almost impossible for us to expect that our system will remain the same way it was 10, 15 years ago. So it is important that together as a system, we understand these realities. And then we come together as partners to be able to address them. Like, how can we work together in addressing these concerns, and not necessarily about these are your issues. You are the organization that is supporting persons who are homeless, and then you must be taking full responsibility for it. These issues are systemic issues. They affect us as an entire, you know, community, and then it's almost impossible to expect one entity to be able to provide solutions to those problems.
Is that a lot to ask of a community? Because, you know, on the flip side, people in that area have been dealing with this for many, many years. And while you do speak truth, there's also the other truth, which is, you know, I should be able to live in my home and do my business and walk the streets without feeling particularly endangered or threatened. So I understand you want to look, this is the reality of it. But on the other side, how much are people supposed to swallow before things change? And then we're going to start to, like I said, find a harmony so that we can address these issues within our community. At the same time, people can feel that the community is a safe and still a good place to live.
So let me share an email I received from the management of a school not too far from 310 Division, where they said something about, oh, there are so many unwell people who are coming around this space and all that. We don't want to see unwell people around. Well, in the first place, I kind of had a problem with the term unwell, like certain people being referred to as unwell people. And then the question is, would it be different if it's somebody that we normally would perceive this is not a homeless person? It becomes congregating when it is homeless people who are doing it. But would it be said as the same if it's regular members of the community who are gathered having a chit chat or something? Would people complain about that? So I bring it to what the point I raised earlier about the issue of comfort as opposed to safety. For instance, Transition House has experienced a lot of hate. Some of our staff members don't even feel safe. They're not proud to say, I work in this organization out there, because of the level of hate that they're going to get. Our board, our management have suffered the same. And the simple reason is that we are the one who have chosen to do to take on the responsibility that most entities would not take on, which is supporting the homeless, people. We should look at it, not doing that, not supporting the homeless people, where does that put us as a community? Would we rather that we have, encampments? Would we rather that persons are living rough in our community? Or would we rather, okay, we have a facility that has been put together to support these individuals. How do we work together to ensure that those individuals are well served and then that our community is safe? I know that there's no easy way out of this, but we need to be having these difficult conversations and then the willingness to be able to shift posts.
Ike Nwibe, I want to thank you so much for taking all this time to talk to me.
Thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate the opportunity.
That was Transition House Executive Director Ike Nwibe. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.